Welcome to Executing the Vision podcast. I'm your host, Brad Hunter, president of Emerge Labs. On the podcast, we'll get to know the person behind the vision, their successes, their challenges, and their plans for the future. If you're interested in becoming a guest or know someone who might be a good fit, stick around to the end and we'll discuss how to apply. Now, enjoy the show. Okay, everybody, welcome. We got another episode of Executing the Vision. Today, I have on the podcast, we've got Chris Schutrups, the founder of Mortgage Hut, who, boy, I tell you what, doing a little research on you, not shy of winning awards over there, huh?
Thank you very much. Yeah, no, thank you. An incredible team behind us, for sure.
Nice. Let's start off. We'll get to all the mortgage stuff for sure. Let's just start understanding a little bit more about you and life growing up. What are you all about?
Yes, I was actually born in Scotland, and not many people know that about me because of my accent, and that I'm as far south in the UK as you can go. If you go any further south, you're in France, pretty much. So I'm right at the bottom, but my parents were from England, down in the south as well. That's where they lived. My dad was Dutch, my mum was English, and they moved to Scotland to start a new life in hospitality. And they bought a pub and they had bars. And I then came along and was born. And then the recession of the late 80s, early 90s hit. And unfortunately, they lost everything. So we went from a relatively affluent life to living in a small council house, like what an American would call maybe a housing project type of thing, in a council house. And we had eight of us plus our four pets, and we lived on the equivalent of $4 a day, £3. And life was tough, and it was really tough. And my dad was going out and selling like sandwiches out the back of his car. When I moved down south when I was four, they basically started from scratch. My dad went from being, when he was down in the south previously, an assistant general manager of a hotel, to being the guy who washed the dishes at night. So it was a real journey of going from one extreme to another, I would say.
The true entrepreneurial journey from, yeah, the ups and downs and all of it.
Yeah, and it's a journey in itself, isn't it? Because I think up until my second job was, I was a stockbroker in the City of London, which is the same as Wall Street. And that was probably where I learned. I went from thinking, look, I need to work really hard to have money, to have nice things, to realizing money didn't make me happy. And that's typically a thing that rich people say. Yeah, they go, oh, money doesn't make you happy. And you go, well, you've got loads of it. So of course you're going to say that. you know, and that's not, I guess that's not lost on me, like running a load of businesses and doing relatively well. For sure, money can make you comfortable, but not happy. And I guess through my childhood, it was just, okay, my mum and dad worked exceptionally hard, were great people, but really were coming from nothing again and lost their confidence. And I guess one of the things I learned from my dad, who had many great qualities, but one mistake I think he made, was he never got back on the horse. And in business, it does go wrong and it doesn't. And don't get me wrong, it's painful. But that was probably one lesson that he taught me, was get back on that horse if it doesn't go quite right. So yeah, that was me, really. Pretty normal, maybe slightly poor upbringing. I went to a super diverse school, which really I found so amazing. Maybe, and I still work with that school now, and some of the pupils and the head teacher does an amazing job. But at the time, it was a bit of a troubled school. But we all had our own quirks. We're all a little bit troubled. We're lots of different nationalities. And I think that also helped me in life, being able to communicate with people from different walks of life. I look at some of my amazing friends who came from private schools that were all boys' schools. And I think that there are some downsides to that as well. And that's why my children don't go to private school.
Yeah. I had an upbringing in like rural Michigan.
Yeah.
Where for the most part, where we were, like, private schools wasn't really much of a thing, but there were some private schools not too far away. And for me, in that scenario, it was like the kids in the private schools seemed to have more they had access to money and they had freedom. Their parents weren't around as much, which all ended up equating to them being like just more trouble. It really was. It really, to me, grew up was like, I don't see the advantage of that at all. Like, to me, every kid I ever met that went to a private school just like for the most part, was more of a troublemaker. But now we're out here and now we're in California. And I have a slightly different view of things now, because now, to me, the California public school system is just terrible. But more private school out of a need to just some normal. I just want them to get to a normal situation, but not what they get exposed to in the public schools here.
Yeah, I go to Nevada quite a lot, and I go to Vegas probably 10 times a year. And I meet a lot of Californians that have moved from California. And I see both sides of it, because when I look at, I'm in some of the Facebook groups of Vegas locals, and someone occasionally will be like, what's the worst thing about Vegas? And they'll put Californians. But then I see them, it's just great fun. And I see them all arguing online. It's brilliant. You just get your popcorn ready to go. But also, speaking to the Californians that are moving to Nevada, it's an interesting view of how, from at least how they explain it, that it's changing pretty quick there as well, and becoming and a very expensive place to live as well.
Yeah. It's funny. And we right now are on that thing of, we may be relocating. Right. We're talking about it. We're just over all the stuff here. And it's so interesting, because any place you look at to potentially relocate from California is a place where probably a lot of people from California have relocated to. And people don't have this attitude of, oh, God, not someone else from California.
I think it's a pretty expensive place to live now as well, isn't it?
Oh boy. There's, as far as like major cities, there's not a lot of affordable ones left. Stuff isn't like dramatically. If you want to go dramatically, if you want to live somewhere where cost of living is like what it should be, it just isn't a city anywhere almost. So you go out to some.
Oklahoma was cheap for property when I was there last year. Where I was at the start of this year was Thailand. And for probably about $2,000 US, you can live a very nice life in Thailand. People, you see the videos online, people are living on $800, $1,000, but you want a quality of life, I think. But
right.
But it's different, because instead of getting an Uber, I was getting a Grab, which is like Uber, but a little moped turns up.
Right.
My dad was Dutch, I'm massive. So I'm like on the back of this moped trying to hug this tiny little Thai guy who's riding through the traffic left. It's a different experience.
In what part of Thailand were you in?
So I went to Chiang Mai, which is, I suppose, being dubbed at the moment as the digital marketing mecca of the world. Lots of digital nomads, a lot of Americans who will market, mainly marketeers. And if you go onto their LinkedIn, actually, they say that they're in New York or Florida or LA, but actually they're sat with their shorts on and their t-shirt charging LA prices, but living on Thai cost of living, which is, I think, digital nomad is the new backpacking if you don't want to live in a dorm of 30 people as you're traveling around the world, and you can do some web development or a bit of SEO or a bit of. And I have a favorite American band, actually, and one of their lyrics refers to the fact that they went to uni, but they could learn it now all on YouTube, essentially. And that's so true, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm with the cost of college and stuff here in the States, I just think there's going to have to be a massive shift as to how people go. Because for the most part, I don't see how it makes any sense anymore. In some situations, but not this like default, everybody should just go to four-year university. It's like, are you crazy? You're going to come out with a $250,000. How do you get out from under that?
You look at AI, okay, like I was running a team. I was running the largest mortgage business in the Middle East, and we had a team of developers. And I would say half the developers we had at the time were home taught. They taught themselves, and we would grade them as they came through the interview process. But if you look two, three, 4 years ago, I was saying, look, if my children, they should be coders. That's absolutely what they should be. That's the way. But look at how AI has progressed so quickly. And actually, I can only imagine, and I have no insight at all, so this is just a guess, but running a university, trying to teach people relevant skills that are important right now, to have your finger right on that pulse and put someone through a 3 or 4 year degree. They start at one point when they start that degree.
Yes.
Really different at the end of it.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so now talk to me. How are we transitioning into the mortgage world from growing up? Like, when did that transition really start to occur? You were first trading stocks.
So I started in HSBC. So basically, I got asked to leave college because I was way too chatty, had way too much fun going to parties. And the principal said to me, look, you should just take the year off and come back. And I was like, oh, goodness, this is not good, because my dad was a super stern Dutchman. And I went home And I said, look, I've been kicked out of college. And he was like, oh, he was losing his mind. So I went for a load of job interviews. The first company to offer me the job was HSBC Bank. And I started in their call center. It was before the credit crunch. I was 16. I was working 12-hour compressed shifts. So I worked 3 days a week. Then, because I didn't have a girlfriend, couldn't drink alcohol, I basically did another 2 days a week on top, 12 hours. And lo and behold, I was the top in this call center of 300 people, 300% to target. And I got the job as a stockbroker, and I did that for a couple of years. It was a really intense job. You weren't allowed to sit down apart from on your lunch break. You didn't have dialers or anything. You had to make 400 calls a day. It was really intense. And then you progressed up to being a broker, but it was hard work, and probably the most unhappy I've ever been. And I came back into retail banking in a very, if you've seen, I guess, The Holiday, if you think about that movie with Cameron Diaz, in a really small little village, running a tiny little branch. And I did that for 6 months or so. And I thought, this is very relaxed, but I'm not sure this is going to do me forever. And so I got trained by a corporate estate agency in mortgages. I went, it's like a real estate agency company trained me to do their mortgages. And a year into that, a really talented chap that I worked with, who was an estate agent, said, a real estate agent said to me, look, why don't you come and do the mortgages? I'm going to start my own real estate business. And I was thinking, I was already top in the region. I'm thinking, I'm going to have gold-plated teeth and be driving a Bentley before I know it. This is going to be the dream. And I left the job, and that week, when I started, he actually took an employee job. So suddenly I had no leads, no customers. I'd started with about $12,000, £10,000. And by then I was down to $5,000, £4,000. I had a pregnant partner, I had a house to run. And I was thinking, oh no, this is going to be a problem for sure. And so that's where the mortgage business started. And that was around about 13 years ago. It was me and a dog just trying to carve out any opportunity, speak to anyone, or just try and scrape to get by. And I've said before that actually what ended up happening that first 6, 12 months, I had such little money because our cash flow pipeline's between 6 and 9 months from when we first speak to a customer. So it's a very long lead time compared to some of the other businesses that I own, say in hospitality, where the cash flow, it turns the next day. And so I was so poor that I used to have to go to my mum and dad's house and get like bread out the cupboard and get them, because I would get paid the commission on a Wednesday. And by the Monday, I had no food and I had no money in the bank and I had no credit card. I was pretty screwed. So that was the journey into mortgages. And then it's been an exciting journey since. And we're now a business that touches 100 or so customers every day contact us. We're a team of 50 people. We deal with 12,000 mortgage products, 110 different lenders, turning over millions and millions per annum, and very tech enabled. So, a different business. The world in mortgages has changed over that period of time as well, but a business that definitely is still on its journey. I'm not, I don't, thank you for having me on the podcast, by the way, but I'm not on here telling my story of how I got here. I'm like all the business owners who are listening to your podcast right now. I'm on that exciting journey of building something great.
Yeah, cool. And so then one of the reasons I was excited to talk to you, because so over my journey here, I stumbled into software like 13 years ago. We were doing more kind of consulting work in the wireless space, actually. And there was this need that seemed very evident where it's commission reconciliation. You take a whole bunch of data. You have to take the data from the carrier and you take the data from your point of sale, and you have to do all these different calculations to make sure you're getting paid correctly. That's a big process in wireless. And we were doing this whole thing for clients where, we were training people how to do it. You're taking like five Excel spreadsheets from here and five from there and all these formulas and blah, blah, blah. And we kept hiring more and more people to do this. And we got up to the point where we had a pretty good sized staff doing this. It was one of those things of, I don't know anything about software, but what we're doing seems like software should be accomplishing that goal. Like it just reached this point of looking to hire more people. I'm like, hold on a second. All these people are just processing data. Why don't we build? So lo and behold, that's what we did. And so we still have that to this day. Like the biggest dealers in the country utilize our platform to do their reconciliation. So that's how I fell into software through that. And then through that, we built our platform and wonderful. But then I had this kind of bigger team and okay, we need to cut back the team. And I was like, I don't like the idea of cutting people that have been good. So what else can I do? How about we take part of this team and start developing software for businesses?
So then
randomly ended up into that. So over the years, I've stumbled into all sorts of different industries and doing it. Agriculture, done a bunch of stuff there. And then mortgage bank, same thing. Accidentally stumbled into the whole thing. And then spent a year and a half working in a mortgage bank, a nationwide mortgage bank here in the States, with the initial intention of coming in on the consulting side, helping with growth and strategy. And then after getting in there too, because they're a very tech forward, I was blown away by the sheer cost of technology, the amount of different platforms that it takes. Right. In the end, the loan officer on the end, they have all these slick things is how smooth, but boy, to create that slick, smooth process is an unbelievable amount of technology and an unbelievable amount of these different niche products.
And a lot of, if you want to do anything, I remember I once spoke to there's a large bank here in the UK, and I wanted to add a box, a free format. Oh, there was a free format text box with a list. Okay. And I said, I just want to add another developer in there. And they said, okay, just to scope that workout is $100,000. You know, and you're like, what the hell? And it's because, you know, you only have to look at, there's a bank here in the UK that was owned by a Spanish bank that was sold called TSB. And they decided they would replatform all the customers, take them to a new system, do it all. And then they replatformed them and it was a disaster. Some customers couldn't access their money in the bank accounts for 6 months. They missed mortgage payments. Businesses couldn't pay their staff for months and months. And I can imagine what you saw was a lot of a crazy system behind it, but also something that had been, the architecture had been really well planned out over a long period of time.
Yeah. Well, to me, there was like two elements. It is all of a sudden you were sitting down looking at all the numbers of just the business as a whole and trying to figure it. And you start looking at all these like, we're paying how much for what platform? Show me that platform. We're paying $8,000 a month. What does that thing do? And you're like, that's crazy. And so since then, the past couple of years, we've spent time just rebuilding and mirroring a lot of these platforms and replacing, right? Because there's definitely certain ones that it's just, this is too much money. This is a niche product that is simply overcharging you. And you can rebuild this thing for significantly less money and fill in that weird little niche gap. Now, the major, to me, what I always tell people is when they look at like the custom development thing, it's like any of the big platforms, like your main platform that's interacting and has APIs all over the place that you're spending a fortune on, sorry. Keep spending a fortune. Don't try to replace that stuff because that is really difficult. That takes a really large team and is...
And that's a reason why they can get you on
the path. But it's those like second, third tier kind of things that are doing these little niche pieces that like, I don't know, there's only two choices out there. It's either this guy or the other guy. It seems overpriced.
Yeah.
Like those are the ones where you can dig in and yeah, you know what? There's a significantly better. So yeah. So on the tech side, a lot of experience on that side of things. And then to me, the most interesting piece to learn about all the industry was the sales and marketing side. And we developed a training program when I was there, because when I first came in, it was like, okay, when new people come on board, how do they learn? You just shadow somebody and you learn next to them. And it takes about a year and a half to really get it dialed. In the beginning, we go over some stuff, the approach of let's do better than that. Let's sit down and let's really dedicate some time to building out a true training. And what does that involve? And what do people need to know? And then it was been interesting since going through that, seeing how one place does it compared to another.
Yeah.
Right. And seeing those massive gaps of, oh, you're not even teaching the people that whole huge section at all. Plugging them into a chair and hooking them up to a dialer.
Yeah.
And so those are the pieces of the puzzle that I love. So tell me what you guys have been killing. Like I said, you've got a laundry list of, and for several years of awards all over the place. What is your key to success? What is it that puts you guys so above and beyond your competitors?
I think it's putting the customer at the heart of what you do. We, coming from a large billion-dollar tech business, the belief there was you don't build a system for us. You don't build a process for us. You build it for the customer to make it as simple as possible, because actually that frictionless, it's a little bit like being on Amazon, and one minute you're looking at something, the next thing it's in your hand and you're like, how did I even buy that? And that should be a bit of a journey. You know, when I started the mortgage business 13 years ago, people were going out and seeing people in their houses. Then we transitioned way before COVID across to telephone and video-based appointments. Now we're just about to launch something next week in the business where actually, instead of us having to speak to the customer and gather their information and get their credit report and get their ID and scan everything and send everything via email and do this, actually, when the customer books an appointment, it'll automatically trigger a link that sends them to a portal. In 2 minutes, we can have their ID without them showing us any ID using electronic IDMV. We can have their full credit report that pulls straight into our fact find system. If they put any property details in, we can see the year it was bought, built, how much it sold for, a desktop valuation. And then we're able to then smart source, we're able to source directly on the customers on their specific circumstances. Because if you call up someone and they're at work or they're busy and it's like, oh, how much is your car loan a month? Well, about £300. About doesn't work with lenders. We need specifics, but actually, who knows the specifics of everything? They don't. So what we've done is we've used a lot of technology to be able to actually move that customer all the way along. But by the time that they actually speak to one of our mortgage specialists, who their whole job is to just make sure that the customer feels super important, answer all the questions that they may have, and really reassures them, because we don't do mortgages every, you know, in the UK, how it works is we'll buy or sell a house every sort of 7 to 10 years. We don't have, or we do, but they're not very common, 30-year fixed rate mortgages, 25-year fixture. So actually you'll fix for 2, 3, or 5 years. So the customers come back a lot quicker, but it's still not a very regular transaction. So our job is to make it as simple as possible for them, give them as much information as we can, and put them at the heart of what they do, of what we do, because ultimately they're our best marketing strategy. And we have really good niches as well in our business, where we deal with lots of complicated customers, the self-employed, people with adverse credit, but we also are the UK's largest broker for police forces and federations in the UK. We're the largest broker for aviation companies, British Airways, Virgin Atlantic, all of those airlines, EasyJet, Ryanair. So our customers, we carve out the niches that we're looking at. We make sure that we drive the experience forward using like the best people, and we can get the best people if we have the technology that makes their job easier so that they can earn the most money. Oh, look, a candle just went off in front of my desk, actually, as you can see from the little. Don't worry, my house isn't on fire. And so it's just, I guess, you know, as a business leader, you asked how we can do so well, and can actually, you've got to really believe it in your heart that the customers are the most important thing, because there are so many companies who have great vision statements, great company values. But when you actually, and I can think of a couple of financial services businesses in the UK, I can think a couple of in the US that have in the last sort of 5 years come up for opening dummy accounts and
Right.
getting and think, you know, actually, when you are a leader that says to your team, I don't care what you sell people, just do the right thing for our customers. And that in the long term, maybe we a little bit of profitability here and there occasionally if we're not super squeezing that lemon. But actually, our customers are so happy that they go away and refer us to everyone else, which is a very cheap cost of acquiring the customer, really.
And now, how has the industry been over there the past couple of years? Because here has been an absolute bloodbath, right? The past couple of years, we're finally at the point. I think basically what's happened is so many have gone out of business that there's so few left that now the few that are left are able to do okay.
Well, I think it's not been a terrible market here, because how it works is you're sat in your house, you've got a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. What that creates is a problem actually in the real estate market, because you go, look, I'm not going to move to that slightly bigger house because I'm on like a 2%, 3%, 4% rate. I'm not going up to a 5, 6, 7% rate. Whereas here in the UK, there is that cliff edge. So we have two sides of the business. One is those customers purchasing new homes. Okay. The other side is customers coming off of fixed rates who need to refix that rate, either after 2, 3, or 5 years. So what we saw was a subdued market on the purchase side, because people were like, I don't know if I can afford it, going from our cheapest rates got down to 0.99%. And at one point, they reached sort of 6 and a bit%. So that was a huge shock for people. But what it did mean is all those customers coming off of fixed rates where their mortgages were literally doubling, okay, were literally doubling, you know, they were suddenly thinking, holy, holy crap, we need advice. And so our business actually did relatively well because when the rates were low, there was no urgency to refix your mortgage. You're like, oh, you know, it's cheap. Who cares? The rates aren't going anywhere and it's still cheap. And I'll give you a call back, Chris. Whereas actually, we had customers sort of 7 months before their rate was up saying, look, we're desperate to get some security because actually, if our mortgage goes from $2,000 to $4,500, with no pay increases, because at the time there weren't really a lot of wage inflation, wasn't as strong as consumers would have hoped for sure. That was a real challenge. In a lot of ways, our economy has done worse than the US economy, but from a rate and mortgage point of view and a mortgage broker point of view, it's been, you know, our industry, a little bit like the US to a certain extent, is very heavily regulated. We have only a fixed amount of mortgage brokers. Our market also works that we don't, our banks don't have large sales forces like your banks. So they do have sales forces, but actually, probably if I was guessing, most banks, at least 70% of their mortgage business comes from the broker market. Whereas I would guess in the US, it might be a little bit more evenly split.
Yeah, I think a lot of the US banks that were real big in mortgages a couple of years ago have since either completely shut those divisions down or thinned them out dramatically, for sure. And so then too, the other thing in the US is the refi market here is very boom and bust. Right. And when rates dropped down during COVID, it was just bonkers. You couldn't even, like, rates were so great and the banks couldn't even, they couldn't even pick up the phone to answer the call. They were so busy. But then it goes, and then now you're in this thing where, like, you hardly do. You're 10% of your things are refis, or you're really, it's all purchase. So it's that back and forth, but you have to be able to quickly move from where purchase to refi, boom, get here it comes, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, there's definitely more of that
Hear
kind
it,
of.
just everyone, pretty much everyone has to face that cliff edge within 5 years, you know. And you know that works well actually for the property market because, and we also have it so that mortgages can be ported across, so you can take your mortgage with you to your new house. I don't know if that's the thing in the US. So you can take your mortgage because actually you're going to pay a higher rate at some point because the fixed rate ends. There are some lifetime products, there are some, but actually, as consumers, we're probably a little bit overly optimistic, and no one wants to fix at 5% for 30 years just in case it comes down to 1% again, which it probably isn't going to. But there is, I guess, that, yeah, the market does work differently. And that means that the property market doesn't have that same boom or bust either, where people, interest rates fly up and people think, well, I can't move because my mortgage is going to, the whole thing goes up. Actually, if you move in the UK and you port the mortgage, if your mortgage is, say, $300,000 and you need an extra 100,000, only the extra 100,000 is on the new rate. So it makes it a lot, the market effectively works a little bit
And boy,
outside of our market, but that sort of keeps it moving.
I do imagine on the back end, you dealing with that port's got to be a whole other. I'm guessing that's not a simple process to
Oh,
get that.
actually, like the banks make it very easy to keep customers with them, put it that way.
Oh, okay. So they are
I would
friendly
say
to it. Okay.
both banks are pretty good at, and we actually, the other thing is, so you get to the end of the 2, 3, or 5 year fixed rate, and most banks will also pay brokers again to keep the customers with them. And not the same normally, but we're very heavily regulated market. So commission doesn't, we have no real price bias in our market. So when I worked in Dubai, you could have some lenders that paid you 0.5%, some that paid you 1.5%. And it was completely unregulated. You know, as I worked for a large business backed by the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, and my boss was like, look, it's very clear we want to have great customer outcomes, which was why they brought someone from the UK, a very heavily regulated market, to run it. So we actually, I would say to my advisors, look, we're only going to recommend based on price, that's it. And some of the banks would come to me and they go, what, why don't you recommend our product? And I'm like, because it's not the best product for the consumer. And they'd be like, yeah, but we pay you like one and a half percent. What's your problem? I'm like, how about you cut the commission, you know, give the customer a better deal, or even better, keep the commission the same and give the customer the better deal. But until you give me the best deal, I'm not going to send my salespeople out recommending something that's fifth best for our customers, because that's not, whether it's a business that I run and own or a business that I was employed to run, that I'm never going to sell my soul to the devil for that, for sure.
Okay, so from a customer's perspective, you're very customer-centric, want to make sure you're always getting them the best. Now, what about from an employee perspective? Do you call them loan officers over there? Or what do you call
We
that?
call them mortgage brokers or mortgage advisors.
Okay, mortgage. So what is it? I'm a mortgage broker over there. I'm in the space. I'm working somewhere else. What is it that's going to want to bring me over to you?
The first thing that normally brings people is we are an exceptionally busy company. And if you're a salesperson, the challenge that a lot of mortgage brokers have is acquiring customers. As with any business, I own businesses across the whole spectrum. And actually, what I know is the secret to a successful business is having customers. That's it. And you know that with your business. Anyone listening who runs a business goes, yeah, Jesus, that actually. Either they're like, this guy's talking like this is the most basic thing, or they're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But having customers, then it's actually what we try and do is we employ our advisors are employed. So a lot of the UK market, they're self-employed consultants. And with that, they can do their own thing. And if they want to go and play golf, they can play golf. They can do this and they can. But from a customer experience point of view, if we're doing your mortgage today and you call up and I'm like, oh, hey, Brad, by the way, no, your advisor, Tim, he's actually playing golf today. With his tractor. He's having great fun. The sun's out. He's having great. He'll call you tomorrow. You're thinking, well, okay, fine, but that's not the best experience, especially if you're paying us to do it. So I employ all of my team members, which means I pay them a salary, but I can also tell them that they're set working hours. But the benefit is we try and make a good work-life balance for our advisors. So they all work from home. We have checks and measures and software to be able to ensure that they're working and we know that they're working. But actually, the way that we pitch it is we want adults to work for us. We'll treat you like an adult. If you've got kids, if you need to go and pick the kids up for half an hour in a day, no problem. Just make sure you do your hours and make sure your customers are happy. Because the only time I'm ever going to come and be annoyed at you is when a customer's unhappy. And we pay well. We have a very transparent commission structure, actually. I could sit here and say, we pay you the most commission. Maybe we don't. It depends on your performance, is the truth. But what we have is a super transparent commission structure for our advisors. No hidden, there's no plus and minuses. There's no hidden KPIs that they have to hit to get it. The bottom line is, if we earn money as a business, they earn money as a business. You know, because actually, if their customer experience, if they're getting all those Google reviews and the other reviews and they're all coming in good, and we're making money, they're going to share in the wealth, they're going to do well. And then if we treat them like adults and empower them to be treated like adults, then they're going to work like adults. And so you create this environment. And then what happens is actually when I recruit now, I have a team of 25 regulated financial advisors who are mortgage advisors. And when I recruit, all I do is I say to my mortgage advisors, guys, if you know anyone who you used to work with or who's a friend who'd be interested in working for us, let me know. Guess what? Though they bring me people who, one, they know, so they're not going to bring me anyone who's like a crackhead who's going to start being a pain. But on the flip side, their friend knows that they go and recommend to their friend. They say, this guy Chris, he's super cool, he treats us really, we've got loads of leads, loads of opportunities to speak to customers, good quality customers. And so they do the selling of our business to the new recruits, and they explain it and they answer their questions. And I say, just be honest with them. And actually, we don't even incentivize the advisors to bring people. It's not like I say, look, I'll give you $1,000 if you bring me a new. But they're I once learned, okay, from a really talented business coach. He said to me, Chris, your main job is to be the chief storyteller. And that's what I am. My job is to tell the team where we're going, what we're trying to achieve, what we aspire to be. And then, and I have to live and breathe that as well. I can't just be there like in Vegas, chilling in the casino, like with my feet up, going, oh, you know, you guys, you got to work really hard. And it's 8 degrees Celsius and it's raining in the UK. You know, when I work in Vegas, I get up at 4 a.m. Vegas time. I work through to 3 p.m. and I work on UK time zone. And then I'll go and have fun. Then I'll go out on the boat or, you know, go to a pool party or go to the casino or whatever. But actually, like in the recruitment process, I recruit all the financial advisors myself. And I say, you'll probably work harder than you've ever worked before in this business because we're busy, but you're going to love it. Okay, but what I can promise you is you're never going to work harder than me. And when you lead from the front like that, I think people will get behind you because actually, as a leader, if I make a mistake, if I get things wrong, I'll sort it out as well. I've done this for long enough that the team I still have. So I started this business in 2011. I still have my first mortgage advisor working for me who joined me then. And most of my team have been with me over 5 years. If you, and that's where you earn real money. when they're, because all those renewal customers we've been talking about,
Right.
when they come back, they don't cost me anything to acquire. So if my guys are doing a great job and those customers are coming back, actually they get to a point where they say, Chris, we can't take any more new customers. And that's when you have to add more in and add more in it, and you get that growth, that quality growth in a business.
And now talk to me, is the back end very similar to here? You've got your pre-processing, underwriting. I assume that that's very similar, right?
Yeah, that's it. So we will
Yeah.
speak to the customer. We have a system which sources the deals, which will pull through depending on how many lenders you have. We have what's known as the whole of the market. So 110 lenders, 12,000 products. So the advisor will pick, and that's where, again, talking about technology, having good technology to try and make it more efficient for the advisors. Our average advisor will generate an income a month, typically about $17,500, which is significantly higher than the industry average here. Our aspiration is by the time that we hit the end of next year, that will be $30,000. And that's not by working them harder and saying, actually, you don't need sleep, guys. You stay awake all the time.
Yeah.
It's about using technology to empower them,
Yeah.
not eroding that customer experience, not taking away from that personalized journey, but actually using technology to enable them. Like what I said, moving that customer, we've just taken an hour out of the process by moving the customer along. Does it erode the journey? No, the customer still speaks to an advisor. We're not sat on live chat. They're still there. If they want to Zoom, if they want to meet a local advisor, we can still meet them in their local coffee shop or go and see them at home or whatever. But actually, people don't want that. No one wants to, apart from my team, no one cares about mortgages. Mortgages is something that you need to get your dream house. You don't want to talk to someone for 3 hours about your mortgage. You want to talk to them as little as possible, know that you've got the mortgage you need, which is the best deal you can get, and that you're going to be able to either keep or get your dream home. That's it.
Yeah.
So the process is they speak to them, they get it, what we call agreed in principle, which would be like a pre-approval for you in the US. They find a house. We submit the application. Depending on the lender, normally takes about 2 weeks to get the mortgage offer issued. And then in the UK, a mortgage offer is legally binding. The lender can't retract it for 6 months.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then we get paid right at the end, generally, by the lender.
Yeah.
Customer draws.
Okay. Yeah, and I'll tell you one thing from my experience that I really noticed as far as like the running of the mortgage business and the loan officers really being happy and the recruiting and bringing new people in, what is it they're really looking for? First and foremost, it's always the marketing side of things, right? How is the business going to come in?
Yeah.
And secondly, a big piece of the puzzle that I previously hadn't really dawned on me as much is that back-end support. And that back-end support from how good and efficient it is one factor. And I tell you, the other equal factor is just the kindness involved. Just that idea that every scenario is different. Problems are going to come up. And how is that underwriter, how is that processor, how are they interacting with the loan officers? Are they being kind? Are they being helpful? Are they trying to do their best to make the deal work? Or are they just having an attitude, complaining? Like, really, to me, in the end, it was that element of the business that was very embedded in their culture, where just people are just always super kind to the other people in the business. And there would be the few outliers that weren't, and they would get weeded out
Oh,
immediately.
100%. It's all about culture, and I own a restaurant, for example, and chefs. We've all seen Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmare. We've all seen him swearing and shouting. I have a very simple rule across all of the businesses. I do not shout at people, so no one will shout at each other. And I don't have that. And I think, as you know from speaking to me, I'm pretty positive. I've got a lot of energy. Wake up at 6 a.m. and people say, I love your energy. And I say, be my wife living with me 24/7 and see how you feel then. You know,
Yes,
it's true. When I wake up at 6 and I'm like, ah, let's do this. My energy, I think, I have many flaws, but I guess one of the things that I'm gifted with is I have a positive outlook and I have a quite a contagious, exciting personality. And for salespeople, that's great because if I get up and I'm ready to raring to go, I'm sure I essentially manage the mortgage business to a certain extent off of WhatsApp groups, different ones for different teams, and then we use broadcasts and we use this. But every morning I send them a message like, hey guys, this is our focus, this is what we're doing, this is how we're gonna do it. And I'm sure some of them sit there and think, oh God, I wish this guy would just go away. It's 8 a.m. But it drives us all in the direction. And as you say, it's a culture thing. I'm sure if there were people who really didn't see the vision, didn't see the culture, And as I say, you live and die by your reviews. If our customers understandably are unforgiving, they're unforgiving. If you don't reply to that email that day, they're going to be on you because guess what? This is the most important thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't just leave it for a week and be like, oh, hey, by the way, sorry, I've just been chilling in the hot tub. You need to be on it. And again, it's using technology to be able to do that. We use a CRM, an off-the-shelf CRM system, actually, that we have then customized and got loads of integrations. But we have the, as you say, we have the advisors. Behind the advisors, if the mortgage is submitted, we have like client managers who are the administrators who are with the advisors in the meeting, they're available, they're speaking to them. We then, for the pre-application stuff, we have customer success managers, what I internally call CRM managers, who are just going through every opportunity, making sure the advisors replied. If they haven't replied, they're going, oh, Jimmy, you know, this customer emailed you 3 hours ago with these accounts. Have you got back to them yet? They're always on it and driving it forward. And actually, it's a little bit like children and or training a dog. I'm going to do a bit of dog training with my Labradors who have got a little bit naughty after this as my wind down time. And it's a little bit like training dogs. Every time they do well, you praise them. But every time they do badly, you've got to reinforce that. And it's the same when you're running sales teams, actually. You've got to have that standard and you've got to hold that standard. You can't be like, oh, okay, going, because customers, oh, they're having a bad day. Customers don't care if they're having a bad day. And they shouldn't have to care if they're having a bad day. Ultimately, I'm as a manager, I'm here to support people. I had a colleague last week whose grandma died. We gave him paid compassionate leave, you know, reassigned all his opportunities. But it's my job to make sure the customers get looked after. But if you just wake up out of bed and you think, oh, God, I don't want to, like, you know, I can't be asked with this today. That is not going to fly with me because actually I get up every day. And guess what? Sometimes I don't want to come to work either. I've been out tomorrow night, for example, I'm going to the football. It's corporate hospitality. I'm sure I have some drinks. How am I going to wake up the next day at six and go, I don't know. I'm going to wake up and put my big boy pants on and get on with it, ready to go again. So, yeah.
And now, what's the future look like?
The future is exciting. We've just changed how our regulatory structure works here, which will realize significant profitability. We expect to double our profit in the forward 12 months, which is exciting. With that, essentially, we've gone from what is essentially a little bit like a hidden franchise model where where they do the compliance for you, and to being able to completely define our customer journey. So the new systems that I told you that we've been building out, this has been something that I've been working on with my wife, who's the CF1 director of the business, for the last 18 months. And the future is exciting. We're looking to add some more great people into the team. The one thing as a business we don't struggle with is generating leads. So as we become more efficient, putting more into the top end of the funnel, we plan to start going into wealth and investment advice. Because naturally what happens is as your customers, they come to you when they're 20 and 30 and they get older. And as they get older, they start to pay off their mortgages, they start to have more wealth, and then they start to want to talk about financial planning, whether that be estate planning, inheritance tax planning, which is a tax that we pay here in the UK when you die, whether it be about their investments, pensions. So that's the next journey. But we're pretty excited. We definitely think that we can double, if not triple, our business in the sort of next 12, 24 months for sure. But so we've got a long way to go on our journey, and hopefully we'll be able to help even more customers and offer incredible advice to them.
Awesome, man. That's amazing. Too often do you have that feeling of, oh my gosh, the regulations change, we're actually going to be more, there's potentially more profitable, right? Usually it's the other way around, right? Oh my God, they changed the regulations, we're going to be struggling to survive.
When you're in the UK, you start normally under what they call a network, and they take a slice of the pie and they have aggregated volumes so they can get hidden slices of pies. And actually, although it takes more oversight and a bit more planning and a little bit more systems and control in the business, by controlling that all yourself, actually, you realize that hidden bit of profit that you're giving away to someone else within your business. And also you're able to, what I just told you about efficiency and getting more, making your team members more productive, means your profitability comes up as well. So we're super excited as a team, as a whole team. I think we're super motivated, and going full circle to, I guess, where we started. As long as you put the customer at the heart of what you're doing and you're building that and you're building out from that, I think you can only really, you know, no business is perfect and you're always going to hit bump. We're dealing with humans at the end of the day, and humans are going to occasionally make mistakes, but as long as they're genuine mistakes and you learn from them and that mistake helps you drive the experience forward, the process forward, then great.
Okay. Couple things here then at the end. Number one,
yes,
best piece of business advice you can offer.
Best, I would say just best piece of business advice would be don't focus on the big stuff. Sometimes just making the marginal changes across all the business and being consistent in what you're trying to do, being consistent in what you do and making sure that you value your time and do the jobs that are relevant to you and make sure that you have incredible people around you. Because actually, I'm good at only a very small amount of things, but my team members around me are almost all of them better at their jobs than I am. So surround yourself with good people, be consistent, and don't always focus on the big stuff. Focus on the marginal changes that are going to make the big difference over long periods of time.
Nice. Yeah. And I tell you what, that's one of the things that I see, like from a consulting perspective, especially when you're there, you're going from that smaller company and making your way up, is that idea of those that go out and find really good, talented managers, people that are potentially more talented than them. It's such a different path. Right. There's so fewer stresses. There's so fewer, but it really blows my mind as to how many people, I don't know, almost have this mentality that they don't, I don't know if they don't want those kind of people around or that they get intimidated by having somebody better around
Well,
or.
I think that actually business owners think they're the best at everything. And guess what? You're not, you know, the sooner you realize that you care the most, you're probably working the hardest, but you're not always the best at things. I actually started a thing which I'll just tell you about really quickly, where I don't do emails anymore. So about 2 months ago, I stopped doing emails. I employed a full-time assistant to do emails because I was getting 3,500 notifications a day via email and WhatsApp. And what it does actually is it breaks that chain of thought. You know, the bigger picture stuff, you're like, oh, and you're not able to really focus. You know, whether you're a CEO who earns $50 an hour or a CEO who earns $5,000 an hour, ultimately, whatever you're trying to achieve, you need to be able to focus on the bigger picture stuff, working on the business. And so I employed a full-time assistant. Guess what? Out of, I think, something like 1,500 emails that I was getting a day, I only need to look at 20 of them.
Yeah, that's
You know, because
great.
most of them are scheduling. They're like 14 years of subscribing to different websites. They're people trying to pitch me stuff. And so all that I do is I do half an hour every day with my two assistants. And I'll go through anything that I need to go through. And then I don't look at my emails again for the whole day. And it has changed my life. And for people sat out there thinking, oh, that sounds good. I actually read a book called How to Buy Back Your Time. And I was driving from the Netherlands, from Holland. Are you going to pull the book out? Look at
Right.
that. That is it.
Yeah,
And have you read it yet or not?
yeah. It's so funny. I did the audiobook and ripped through the whole audiobook. It was one of those, wow, that's so good. I'm gonna order the hard copy and really go through and 'cause yeah, it's one of the better books I would say I've read in a very long time. One of the better ones at like really not only explaining like this theory. But then, okay, let's start from day one and let's break down exactly how we're going to do that. And yeah, it's been a great. I'm still now in the reading portion about halfway through. Like I said, the audiobook I did like in a couple days. But then for me, audiobooks is to really take it in. I got to sit down and read it and take some notes and.
I was driving from Holland. I was visiting my auntie, and I drove from Holland to UK. It takes 8 hours, and I just listened to it the whole way there. And I met someone in business, did in a marketing business, and he said, "Oh, you should read this book." And this was on the Friday. On the Sunday, I listened to it. On the Monday, I put the job advert up for the assistant to do the emails. On the Monday evening, I employed the person, and on the Tuesday, they started. So it was. So that's another. If anyone's it's been a bit revolutionary. And most business people, I say, "Oh, I don't do emails anymore," and they're like, "How can you do that?" And I'm like, "Actually, when you actually do it, it's liberating," I would say.
I bet that feeling has got to be awesome. Okay, and then best piece of life advice.
I think it's about getting the balance right, and I guess that segments off of the how to buy back your time. I get up relatively early, but I don't look at my phone. I do a little bit of reading because actually work-life balance is important, is the truth. And we all say that and we all do it and we all believe it. But how many of us are sat there at 11 p.m. still WhatsApping, still emailing, still thinking, oh my God, what about that invoice that I'm owed? Or how am I going to pay this invoice? And actually, I do think I try and walk my dogs twice a day and I try and do a bit of reading. It doesn't mean that I work any less hard. putting a bit of that in definitely has allowed me to have better well-being. Again, from that book, How to Buy Back Your Time, I think they talk about saboteurs, and I was one of the ones that drank too much, is the truth, to be able to self-medicate, to be able to relieve that mind. Whereas I don't not drink now, I will try and do some walking or go on my Peloton. So I guess having that work-life balance and not beating yourself up. That's the,
Yeah.
as business owners, we beat ourselves up. We're like, oh my God, I've got to do this. I didn't do well enough for that. You know what? You're trying and you're doing more than most people. Because if you're doing the things, you're doing more than most people. And just remember, you're human. This is a journey. Don't be impatient. We're all impatient. That's what makes us successful entrepreneurs. But don't beat yourself up. I guess if something doesn't go right, just try and take the positives from that day and remember that tomorrow you wake up and it's a new day.
Nice. Okay, and let's end here. Two things. How to customers, what's the easiest way for a customer to get in touch with you? And what's the easiest way for a mortgage broker that wants to be with a better company and make some more money? How do they get in touch with you?
So I'm on LinkedIn, so either or can find me on LinkedIn, Chris Shoetrucks, or our business, themortgagehut.co.uk. You can reach out to me on there as well. If customers, potential brokers, anyone who's in business that needs any help, support, advice, I'm not a business coach. I'm not trying to be a business coach. If anyone is sat there thinking, oh, I'd like someone to talk to or bounce ideas off of, I genuinely love business. It's a lifestyle for me. And I'd love to hear people's stories as well. Hence how I got onto this podcast, because I listened to your podcast.
Awesome. Okay, we will definitely include those links there. And it's been an awesome conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure, honestly. Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Executing the Vision. If you'd like to be a guest, go to emergelabs.us and click on the podcast page. If you like what you heard, please share the episode and subscribe. Ratings and reviews go a long way to help promote the show. You can find us on Instagram at brad.emergelabs, as well as X, Facebook, and LinkedIn, where we strive to provide valuable information on business and life. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show and what you'd like to see in future episodes. Thank you again and have a great day.